Mental health and wellness are crucial aspects of well-being. Their understanding and acceptance are vital for the progress of society. In a cultural context, mental health is often shrouded in stigma and misunderstanding, leading to a lack of proper support and care for those affected. Heal Your Mind with Tracy Kotzen is a platform for candid conversations that enlighten and enrich our understanding of mental health and wellness. Join us as we demystify, destigmatize, prioritize, and shine a light on mental health and healing. Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Kotzen is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.
Welcome to another episode of Heal Your Mind with me, Tracy Kotzen. Today we're discussing navigating grief across cultures with our guest, Welile Maleka. Welile is the CEO of Camber Coaching and Consulting, a company specializing in leadership development programs, diversity and inclusion, mental well-being, compassion fatigue, moral injury burnout, post-trauma growth, and culture building. In addition, Welile is also a non-practicing lawyer. Welcome, Welile. In addition, we're joined by Hazel Namponya, who is the editor-in-chief of Collective Action Magazine, a multimedia publication which focuses on advancing the response to gender-based violence. Welcome, Hazel.
Thank you, Tracy.
Hazel and Welly, today we're talking about navigating grief across cultures. And we've had so many of these conversations offline, and they've been so profound that we thought it was important to bring this conversation to a wider audience. Welly, from your perspective, why is it necessary for us to discuss grief? One would assume it's like breathing or eating or drinking, this natural, organic thing. But we know from COVID, right, that our grief process were disrupted. The way we try to meld our different cultural practices together in this country means there's this distortion. Why is it important for you that we talk about this?
I think it's important, Tracy, because we just really do badly with the topic of grief. So my experience has been that families, which is where we generally start perhaps experiencing deep grief, are not really conversant with emotional language. So if you're struggling to express how you feel, how do we even start to navigate grief? What does it look like? How do I hold space for someone who's grieving? And I think just the general ambience that we create in a space, in a community, in a family around grief has changed tremendously, at least in the time that I was growing up, and what I'm seeing now. So I think it's a really, really topical subject.
Thanks, Wally. Hazel, what is your take on the importance of this conversation?
I feel that in addition to what Welile has said around the conversations and holding space, there isn't any acknowledgement of the different types of grief. We're already struggling with one type. I mean, we lose somebody. But there are many different types of grief that people go through. And unless we start understanding what grief is and how it shows up, I think we'll continue in this loop as a people. Yeah.
Hazel, when you say types of grief, I think the one we're all familiar with, and you've alluded to it now, is really death. What are the other things we could be grieving that don't necessarily involve the death of a loved one?
Well, for example, in my case, I'm still grieving my marriage. This is 10, 13 years later. You know, when you are in an African context or in family, when you get married, you marry the entire family. Despite the fact that we went through what we went through and we separated, our marriage was very short, actually. But the family still held on for a while with hope, and they still have hope until now. But they forget that I am the person that went through what I went through. And I have been mourning and grieving this marriage and hoping that I'd find some form of closure to it. And there's none in sight, actually. Yeah.
Yes. So I just want to move us into This idea of grief being an emotional state, right? But with the mind, body, spirit being really a single unit, it lives within the body. And how has it affected you to have this very prolonged sort of hanging non-closure in terms of your health, in terms of your body? How is this manifesting in your physical being?
Well, I have to shut it down. That's the unfortunate part, because I have no outlet. when I start, I've tried to start to do the work, and I've done some level of work, but because there is no closure, you have moments, for example, where you think, oh, maybe it might work out, or maybe, you know, and then you have, it's an ongoing cycle. This has come to an end. Then you have hope. Then it comes to an end. Then you have hope, you know. It's an ongoing closure. So it works on your emotions.
Yeah. Thanks, Hayes. Welly, in your work in terms of coaching, but also leaning into your personal experiences, what is the sort of common element that you've seen around grief manifesting in the body? What would that look like?
So I think typically what we're used to is crying. Is the weeping, the onset of weeping that people will describe as just happening at any moment. And in most experiences, it's at the time when they least would want to be seen, to be vulnerable. But what we see is people actually get physically sick. They get ill. They hold it in so many parts of their bodies. And it's one of the questions that I like to ask my coaches, or when I'm working specifically with trauma, is where do you feel the pain? So typically it will be neck, shoulder, lower back, and the tummy. So, and we understand that connection. But people really carry their grief in their bodies.
I mean, Wells, you've just been through quite a profound loss yourself, and it profoundly impacted your health and well-being. Are you willing to share some of that story?
Absolutely. And I'm willing because if it changes someone else's life, then I think, you know, and or at least starts a dialogue between people, between families, I think we'll really be doing something important for society, because, you know, we really are now dealing with what people are calling complicated grief.
Right.
And simply because people don't know where to go, what to do with their grief. And there's almost this feeling, and I'm not sure, Hazel, if you've experienced it, but it's almost like you're given a timeline. Family's there. For if you're lucky, the first 2 weeks. And then when everyone's gotten off on with their lives, they're expecting you to get on with your lives. One friend was just sharing with me that he couldn't even go to church for 6 months. And he was a member of one of the church societies. But because he was Black, for 6 months, he couldn't go to the place where he'd ordinarily run to for solace or for just a sense of community. And he just lost his wife. So with me, I think what I'd really like to highlight is I'll probably call it the inability of family, of the immediate family, to hold each other during loss. That I really want to highlight seriously, because it was one of my loneliest experiences. I lost my mom, for context, in June 2022. We buried her on the 2nd of July. And it just felt like she'd buried the family with her. I didn't have access to anyone I could speak to about what I was feeling. And I distinctly remember calling my sister a year later, like I waited for a year to have this conversation, because you know what grief is like. It brings up so many things. You're asking yourself questions. You're remembering the good and the bad. And you're wanting to bring context, understanding, just so you can park it, you know, just let it go. Just try and create an authentic, natural process around processing your grief. And my sister was livid. I remember her saying to me, and you think this is a conversation you could have with me now. I'm on my way to work. And what state do you think I'll be? What state will I be in when I arrive at work? And I was really taken aback. And I'm thinking, okay, crossed the line. But it made me so angry. And I think it's one of the things we don't talk about with grief is the anger and how it lingers and stays. And, you know, you've got your own anger around the sense of abandonment because someone's left you. I mean, my mom took her last breath right in front of me. I didn't know she was dying. So I was really ill-equipped for the moment. So you've got that anger. And then it almost feels like the family just falls apart because there's no one to hold that space. You try calling and you can literally feel the frustration. Like, why are you calling me? And then almost 2 years to the day, my dad passed. So he passed on the 25th of May this year. And again, I need to just emphasize just normalizing the conversation around death before we even start talking about grief with family members because they don't know what to do. And one of what I call, you know, one of the saddest outcomes is we all go into our little spaces, but we forget the children. And in that moment, they are as vulnerable as we are. And when they're watching their parents, they're emulating what they think is how you should be naturally responding to grief. And that is shut it down and keep on moving. And I think that's really created a challenge for us in terms of developing the emotional language, but also just being comfortable with what we're feeling inside. And invariably, that's going to impact on our health. And I definitely have seen that personally.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that in cultures where the expression of grief has got space and place and it's not only accommodated but actively welcomed, there's a healthier processing of it. And when we talk about cultures, I also want to mention corporate culture. And you'd mentioned about the timelines on grief. Something that truly pains me is this idea of having 3 days of compassionate leave or what family responsibility leave, however it's termed now. And it's bizarre to think that we can process grief in 3 days, put together the funeral and the whole production of that, and then be back at work on Monday and be productive, right? So it's the productivity question. And I think that when we talk about culture, we must really consider business culture because that seems to be the equalizing thing. So in some of our African cultures, the preparation for the funeral is over a week and then family travels in from everywhere and they stay for a prolonged period of time. And you could have relatives around still a month later, you know, if it's in its organic form, not pressurized by everyone needs to get back to work on Monday.
Yeah.
So there's like a double loss in that. And now you're supposed to fake being okay when your whole life is actually falling apart. So if anyone out there is listening to this as an HR manager, please take this as some sort of call to action to really exercise much more compassion around the understanding of not only a person's cultural needs for their mourning process, but just humans in general. Can you expect any human from any culture to be done after 3 days and be productive? Because I will tell you, I will be sobbing at my desk for a good long while still. So there's an adjustment required on that score. Hazel?
I'm sorry for both your losses. I can only imagine what you and your family are going through. But I do have a curious question around grief. Because I think one of the recommendations was if good family could support each other. Is the issue of not supporting each other an issue around relatability more than anything else? So you've lost your mom and your dad, and people around you may not know or understand the gravity of that loss. It's like losing a child, you know. People around you might not understand the impact of it. In my case, not one person in my family has gotten a divorce. I'm the first, I'm the groundbreaker. So there is an issue of not being able to relate. And hence it may come off passive as though, you know, grief, you're not taking it seriously or we don't consider what you're going through. But it's an element of relatability. What's your opinion? Would that be the case sometimes?
Look, I think definitely. I think let's try and narrow it down to siblings, because I have 6 siblings that I think naturally just assumed I'd have them to walk with me and weather the hard with. And yeah, it's relatability. Because firstly, something that I don't think we understand often enough or appreciate enough is that every parent has a different relationship with their child. And yet we're kind of expecting to have the same kind of grief or expression of grief. And a number of things come into play with grief, don't they? And it's one of the reasons why you could have complicated grief if you had a difficult relationship with a parent. There's so much going on for you there. And the one that perhaps felt they were closest to the parent doesn't want to have that hard conversation yet. And maybe that's what you need to shift to be able to get to the place of just authentic grief of someone that you've deeply loved. So definitely a difficult and sticky point. I mean, this is not so relevant, but relevant, because you know how African families, it's very boisterous in any kind of get together. And it's not going to be different when we have funerals. So we were busy in the kitchen and we were cooking, probably just arranging for people to be fed, and won't even remember now what the funny thing was, but everyone just burst out laughing. And just not understanding that there's a nervous laughter. There's different types of laughter. And just the laughter that says, oh my God, are we really here? What are we doing together here? And an uncle almost lost his mind. And it was like, shush, some of us are grieving. You're thinking, hello.
We all grieving.
So relatability, definitely. And I think then again, it's also got to do with relationship. How close are we really? I always say to my family, one of the biggest discoveries many people make when they leave home is recognizing that they're actually roommates.
Actually.
You know? And because we did life together, we thought that that meant we were building deep, meaningful connection with each other. And it's not, it doesn't always turn out to be true. And then grief forces you to come back together. And you actually don't know how to hold space for me. You don't know how to hold space for someone else. And it can really get messy. And I think that's what's contributing a lot to the complicated grief, because you're feeling left down, let down, and you're still frustrated and hurt with the loss. And it's the living that I have found, for me personally, have made my grief journey very difficult. Or more difficult than probably needed to be.
Whilst you said earlier about leaving the children behind, and so I have an abject fear. It's beyond fear. It's an absolute terror. My in-laws are Jewish. And the custom is that the funeral is the next day or as close to possible within 24 hours of the passing, save if there are extenuating circumstances. And all of my husband's family are out of the country. So his brother, who would ordinarily be the point of contact, lives in the States. His sister has also moved out of South Africa, who is in the process of moving. His kids live overseas. So it would come down to me, the non-Jewish person, to put together a Jewish funeral. And it terrifies me because, number one, I wouldn't actually know what to do except that one phone number that I know I need to call where the Jewish authorities actually take over. But because the funeral is so quick, and just for context, in our custom I'm mixed race from Cape Town, Christian. So it's about a week or so, right? Five to 6 days before we would normally have a funeral. And so to have it happen within 24 hours scares the daylights out of me because I don't know how to process emotion when you're in doing things mode to get everyone informed, get the funeral done, get, you know, how do you even feel your feelings? And I think there's probably, I'm anticipating, and maybe I'm making up stories, but I'm anticipating I'm going to have a full-on crash after that because it's going to happen so fast. And the first Jewish funeral that I went to, I was very confused because no one was crying. It was somber, but there wasn't sort of an outpouring of emotion. And I was very confused. And I must admit, shamefully now, but I must admit that I thought, I don't know if this person was loved because I couldn't relate. Lazily you laugh, but it's true. I couldn't relate to an expression of grief that didn't involve crying in public as sort of like just the outpouring of my feelings. And I came away from that thinking, geez, I don't know if this person was loved by all the people who are here today. And in hindsight, I know that they were very, very much loved because I've been to several funerals thus far. And we lost Gavin's mum last year. And the grieving process for us was very strange because, as I said, the funeral was the next day. Everyone who lives outside of the country simply could not get back home in time. And so it was a very small gathering of people. There might have been, I don't know, 10 or 12 people. But I know that she was so well loved and the family is actually huge. There are lots of children and grandchildren. And so it was odd. And then Gavin not having the support of his kids because they live outside of the country. So he's lost his mother. And his children have lost their grandmother. But as a family, we could not sit and be together to exchange the stories or the tears or whatever. So I've taken it upon myself to have a funny little practice around this. And this is that I've hijacked all of Gran's recipe books. And I periodically make whoever's favorite food from the recipe book just. And then we sit at the table and we talk about the memories of whatever birthday or celebration where Gran had cooked this thing, and that becomes the talking point because no one seems to naturally want to talk about it. So I have to almost construct the moment, and it feels in some sense artificial, but I know my kids are sitting with pain. I know my husband is sitting with pain. He had a surgery yesterday, in fact, and I kept looking at the door in the hospital expecting her to walk in. And at one point we both looked at the door and looked at each other and we both became teary because she's not here. And so it kind of repeats a year later. Grief is not done, right? A year later. And when you talk about complicated grief, we're also saying that grief can go on for a long, long time. Yeah. They say it should be, and I'm using air quotes, within 2 years, but that is just not true.
Yeah.
It can go on for very long and take so many different forms depending on your culture.
You raise some really, really interesting points culturally. So cultures differ. So you've just described the Jewish burial rites and that happens the very next day. It's actually easier for the one who goes because then we all have to navigate different types of things. Trace, different cultures have got different ways of dealing with the burial rites and the grieving process that accompanies that. So what I would say is, girl, sure.
Get your paperwork in order now already.
Girl, I felt tears coming. And largely because of, I guess, socialization. We are socialized to, you know, to expect, at the very least, a 2-week period where we have family around us. And a lot's happening in that time. So, I think it's still happening in our communities, at least it is, where every day you'll have a prayer at 6 p.m. and people will say words of comfort and just general encouragement to the family, which allows you to go there, to go there. And it's just this space that seems to be created to allow you to grieve, to give you permission. I have a very interesting experience around that lately, because it's evolved into a space where I just think what it was intended for has been lost by a lot of us. And largely because when people now come, they've come from work, they're tired, they're just dropping by.
Yeah.
And being work bees ourselves, we kind of understand that, and we try to respond to that. And so it's become very social. You know, people are laughing, they're joking, and nothing's being talked about around the loss. And then someone starts the service and it's just an encouraging service and people leave. And you blink and it's the funeral. And honestly, Trace, I don't know how I would navigate a burial the very next day.
Mm.
Because with mom, I totally shut down. All I could do every day, and because I grew up knowing that when people come to spend time with you and share their condolences, you're expected to receive them.
Mm.
Literally, I would sit the whole day. I don't know where the hours went. And then I'd hear people and I'd know now's my time. Literally, I'd put myself together and I'd walk into the sitting room. And when it was my time, I would talk. Can't tell you what I said. And then I would walk back into my room and that was it. And that was tough. But what really interested me in what you said was how we perceive people's grief, if it differs from ours.
Mm.
So I had an interesting conversation after my father passed. With my dad, it's definitely complicated grief. We were not in a great space before he parted, but mercifully, we'd started the conversation, we'd started talking to each other, and I'd been able to reconnect with the feelings of being a daughter and wanting to be there for him and support him.
Mm.
But we had things to address, and the last time I saw him, my words to him were, he said he would like us to talk when he comes out of hospital. My words were, can't wait, and it didn't happen. So it was really tough needing to stand up there and talk about the dad that had just lost. And one of the things that happened to me in the moment was a memory came. And I was able to find the father that I had needed at a time in my life when I was going through the most. And he literally was the only parent that was able to meet me at my point of need. And I'm so grateful for that moment because I was able to celebrate that father and be authentic in the celebration of it. But it was a really happy time in my life to have had him in that way. I mean, he was one of my best friends. We had a beautiful relationship until we didn't. And, you know, it was the comments that I needed to field afterwards that I found very interesting.
Mm.
That people thought, I think the final conclusion was I was unsad.
Unsad. Okay,
that's a nice one.
A new word. Unsad.
And actually, they were correct. I was unsad in the moment because I was relieving this moment in time when it had been the best times. And we had actually split the program and we'd said the early days. And I'm a firstborn, so I was navigating these three phases of life that we were choosing to speak about during the memorial. And then we had the glory days, and then we had the last mile. And I spoke about the early days and the glory days. So I actually, in my moment of confusion, of a sense of loss, there was just this ray of sunshine that gave me so much pleasure in that moment. And people seeing that and interpreting it as meaning that I was unsad was very interesting for me. So I didn't judge it, but I was just so curious about what we attribute from an emotional expression to be the right way to grieve. Some people naturally just don't cry. Some people are able to just, keep it together, whatever that means, you know. I lost, I think, the first person I was responsible for actually being part of the process leading up to their burial was my sister. In my language, she's my sister. In English, it would be a cousin. But we had grown up together. She was my older sister, and she died at the Rand Clinic. And because we were so busy, I didn't get the opportunity to sit and be part of the condolences, the prayers. We were so busy just working. 3 weeks later, I learned that depression was real. I used to say to people, it's nothing like depression, it's a Western disease. And
it's very common.
I couldn't lift my head. And so I look back at that time and I look at how functional, how efficient I was. And I'm like, wow, you know, there's so many different ways we show up in grief, Trace. But, you know, besides getting my head around being able to actually bury the following day, the truth of the matter is grieving is a long process. And whichever way you are going to grieve, and it doesn't mean when we've buried a week later or a day later or a month later that suspends our right to grieve. And I think it's a beautiful conversation that that you can start to have with your children as well. So I don't know about you, but I started the conversation on death with my immediate family because I grieved the loss of my grandmother for 6 years. I mean, she was my mother and grandmother. She was also my best friend. She was my advisor. She was everything. And that loss brought me to my knees. I remember having breakfast at a restaurant and suddenly looking at the waiter and wondering what's wrong with him. And he was just stuck. And that's because I was crying and I wasn't even aware of it. And the tears were just rolling down. So it's untidy. Grief is untidy.
That's a hell of an important point, this untidiness of it. And I've been making notes, which actually kind of adds up to what you've just said. So just to close off on this conversation, this little piece of it is I do talk to my kids about it. So my kids know that I want to be turned into a tree. There's this cool pod technology where they put you in this pod and they put a tree on top of you and you become a tree, which is great. Feels like that movie Avatar, something like that. And my oldest son wants to be fired off into space. And the younger one wants to be turned into a diamond, the carbon of his remains. And so it all sounds incredibly far-fetched, but we kind of have these sci-fi conversations. But it's really because it's their language, using movie references, it's the language they can relate to to talk about something that is actually a really hard conversation. Because they wouldn't want to picture me or their dad gone. And certainly as a mother, the idea of losing a kid is unbearable. But the conversation must be had so that we can normalize something that really is the most normal thing, right? You're born. I can't even say pay taxes for some people. That's optional. But you're born and you die. Those are the two certainties. So why are we so scared of it if it's such a natural thing? I want to get into this idea of the complexity of grief.
And it was sort of alluded to in what you were saying, Wally. So two things for me are standing out. One is that community does not mean what community used to mean. Yeah. Community literally meant we all lived in the same physical environment. Mm. We could all walk to each other's houses. That used to be community. And usually the person who had passed would be known by everyone in the community, yeah. right?
Yeah.
Community is not that anymore. Mm. Community is now this international network. Mm. You have colleagues overseas, you have work colleagues who you might be very close to, but have never actually met
yeah.
your loved one. So to that person, it's a stranger. And so I think part of the complexity of grief and why we're struggling to hold on to the cultural practices is because at its foundation, the cultural practice were established in a certain form of community. Mm. But that form of community is crumbling.
Yeah.
And so the practices no longer make sense. Mm. And we're trying to hold them. And certainly we want to. They still belong to us and we still belong to them. But the whole idea of community is different.
Yeah.
So do we need to start coming up with different practices? Is it time for our grieving processes and practices to shift, to change? And if it were, do you convene a council to discuss what they should be? Do they happen organically? So I've got a lot of yeah. questions floating around in that.
Mm.
But I also wanted to talk about the unmessiness of, or the messiness, not the unmessiness, of this assumption that when people have died, we must automatically forgive them all of their wrongs. You know, like, don't speak ill of the dead. They've died. Let it go. But actually, I can still be mad at you, right? Long after you've died, we yeah. can still be mad
yeah.
and miss you and love you and grieve you and mm-hmm. be mad.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about, when you're saying complicated grief,
mm-hmm.
climb into that a little bit for us, and then we can get to Hazel's perspective on the complicated grief of something that is not quite dead. And we'd yeah. started with this sort of hanging, divorce, separation, prolonged. But what mm. else? What else is there sitting in that box?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot you've raised, Trace. Where do you want us to start?
Let's start with community. Because I think it's yeah. linked, right?
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
the community definition yeah. is changing.
Yeah.
And that links to the relatability we were talking about earlier. Because the people we want support from can't necessarily relate because they didn't necessarily know the person.
Mm-hmm.
And because community is different, I think there's also an assigned value. Just because mm-hmm. someone is my father doesn't mean I assign the same value of significance
mm-hmm.
as I would to a best friend that I've chosen for myself.
Mm-hmm.
There's this assumption that just because someone has this biological relationship, you're supposed to be X amount close to that mm-hmm. person. But actually, you can be closer to people that you've chosen for your life. And so there's also part of that complex relatability. And you alluded to it earlier when you said not all kids have the same relationship with their parents.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we could go a lot of ways with this, but I think mm-hmm. let's start at community. I think there's something important there.
Okay. So I want to start with just how we're navigating life away from our communal spaces, at least our communal spaces in terms of family, where we grew up, and we find ourselves in cities.
Mm.
And what that looks like,
mm.
because this is an amalgamation of different cultures and expectations.
Mm.
And then you've got the complexity that you touched on earlier, which is, and then you've got 3 days.
Right.
From, you know, as compassionate leave. And what that looks like and what it does and what it's forced upon families. So in my culture, the family did nothing when a loved one had passed. It was the mm. community that came back,
exactly.
came around to help you bury. So you would probably provide the meat because you would slaughter a cow because it's got significance, cultural or traditional significance. But everyone would bring something. And with the growing availability to funeral policies, insurance has also contributed to how we are burying and how we're supporting each other. Because now people just think, oh, everyone's got cover. So I've noticed that when I would talk to friends and I would say, hey, what are we going to do? So-and-so has lost a loved one. And it's like, oh, okay. But it's not instinctive anymore.
Whereas, well, the insurance will take care of it.
Yeah, insurance will take care of it. And we don't understand what that's stealing from us. Because the minute I think like that, I'm actually withdrawing from being emotionally connected to what's happening. So even when I show up, it's really, really odd. And I've watched this very closely where people I know were very social, and even in my family, would have almost no one on the daily, during daily prayers coming through, except for a very small group of people. And it's something we're not accustomed to, because the other element of grief, the way we grew up, is, Trace, if you lost someone and I was your friend and you told me that I've lost someone that matters to me, I'm coming along. I'm not even thinking about it. It's like, so what time are we going? Yes. You know, now it's, is it my space? It's so interesting. So all these things are coming together to create a really, the English word just disappeared, but there's an English word, but it's, you know, it's, we're not, maybe it's disaffected, a disaffected space where it's there, but it's not close enough. So I'm not feeling anything. So this conversation with children is very important, because I'm having a conversation with my children that says what I'd like to see at my funeral. And that's very important to
absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely.
And I've even said to them, I've started writing my obituary. And they've said, Mom, don't you trust us? And I said, no, of course I don't. I don't trust you. With the way you guys are doing things now, you know, there's messaging that I want. That's honest.
Yeah.
And so touching on your point around, why do we need to lie? I don't know where that's come from. You know, oh, you don't speak ill of the dead. I know that that's what's said in my culture. But, you know, a memorial is for you to recall. It can take you wherever it goes. It doesn't take away from the love of that person. And I've felt really constrained when I've had to speak in certain instances, because I've had to dig really deep to find just the positive. So at what point do we start talking about the effects of toxic positivity?
Ooh, that's a whole other podcast.
And how it contributes to the grief journey.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, what's that about? And then you feel inauthentic. And for me, it makes me feel really lost in the moment around, I mean, the thing that I really wanted to navigate, I just couldn't get it out of my head, was a fight I'd had with my mom when I was in grade 11. And my sister was at the pivot, which is the pivotal point of why we were having this fight. And I just wanted her to remind me what I recalled. It means nothing. It doesn't mean I didn't love my mom. Of course I love my mom. I just, for whatever reason, it was in my memory and I wanted to process it. And her comment was, you know, I love English sometimes. She says, actually, I don't think you'll like what I have to say. And I thought, actually, I would. Because you actually don't understand what I'm trying to arrive at. And it's got nothing to do with creating this rosy picture. Because that's not real life. You know, the hard is always walking alongside the good. And I think there's nothing wrong with us being able to speak honestly about. So with my dad, if someone had asked me, I would have said he started well and he didn't end well. Because
the living still need to learn from that.
Yes.
You know, this is an ongoing learning experience that we're offering each other. Grief is critical in giving us lessons, life lessons. And if we're pretending that everyone is going to say the best things about me, do I need to really try hard in life? Just a question.
That's actually a very valid, true. They can get up at your funeral and spew sanitized stories for 2 hours.
Yeah.
But if you did some things in life that really caused pain, I mean, how does one acknowledge that within the grieving process also, right? Because it's personal.
Yeah.
Pain is personal. The grief is personal. Your relationship with that person is personal. So you might be super mad at them, but someone else didn't have that experience. So they don't carry anger. And then it goes back to the relatability that we were speaking about earlier, because each relationship is completely unique.
Yeah. I know we need to get you to come in, but could I just say this? Because this is so fundamental for me. And I missed it. I missed it when talking about my dad. My dad didn't end well, but I know exactly why. And I wanted to share that. So not many people know, including my siblings, that my dad spent a year in an orphanage with his older brother. When divorce happened, the dad walked off into the sunset. They didn't know where he was. And my gran realized that she wouldn't be able to take care of her sons properly. So she put them in this orphanage, and she told me that it was the best orphanage in the country at the time. And she said to them, I'll be back in a year. They were kids. They'd just seen their dad walk off, never to be seen. And do you think they trusted her?
No.
And so we don't talk about the childhood adverse experiences. In fact, that wasn't just an ACE. That was, you know, that was trauma. Their very blanket of security had been ripped from under their feet. And she came and she worked for an Afrikaans family. She was a domestic for a year. And she saved. And she went back and she started a market. And she went and she fetched them and built a home for them. But what I've always understood about my dad is he has challenges with attachment.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So a lot of what we have experienced is the fear he's always carried in risking loving as he should, and the rejection, the abandonment, the neglect that he had to live with, and which society is still really inequipped to address appropriately. And this is the story of my father. So the one thing he had was he had an ability of connecting with a child's pain. He was a fantastic father. He had a way of just seeing a friend, even our friends, he would see them and he would bring them close. And he just seemed to know. And it would take me to start doing the work that I do to realize why is that, you know, he could identify with that. And so it made him really, really caring, really, really loving, but also really, really afraid of confrontation, of being open and upfront. And I think so much in my family could have changed had he been able to lead in that form of let's address things. So we'd have meetings, but they needed to be sanitized. And the outcome needed to be sanitized. So then you grow up with this understanding that we're family, so we keep it going and we keep smiling. And that's the toxic positivity.
Yeah.
Because when you're really angry with him or you're angry with each other, you don't know how to express it in a healthy way. And there's healthy conflict. And we need to start talking about these things. And we need to be teaching this younger generation around the importance of being open about things like that. Because that's culture building.
Right.
Yeah. So it's so many different aspects. But, you know, you don't talk about that. He didn't want to talk negatively about his dad. But his dad had let them down hugely. But divorce and whatever the narrative in his head was such that he always created this picture of my grandfather being loving, even though he'd abandoned them.
Mm.
And it goes back to your point around my grandmother was deeply, deeply disappointed and hurt.
Mm.
No one marries for their marriage to just to disintegrate.
Mm.
So she carried a lot of pain, a lot of frustration, but she loved her sons.
Mm.
So when he did return, guess what Dad would do?
Mm.
Whenever he was ill, he would go and fetch him from his wife and bring him to his mother to take care of. So we grow up now in this picture that is very confusing. My gran wasn't together and my grandfather weren't together. They weren't together, but he would come back. And then I think in my dad's head, it normalized things.
Mm.
So he couldn't be honest about tension and conflict in the relationship. But who picks up on conflict and in relationship? Who carries the fear and the anxiety and the hurt? The kids, and they don't have a natural expression for that. So as families, there's just so much we need to be talking about around grief, and not just with loss, but the grief of just losing the picture of what a good, happy family looks like, and then the need to recreate that, and where we draw our affirmation and validation. It's not from a healthy processing of our grief. So we don't adjust to the grief. So we actually sentence ourselves to living in this grief bubble that will come at whatever point in time. And that's complicated grief. We need to talk more about it. What do you think?
So whilst you call it complicated grief, in my head I had compound grief. That knock-on effect of the trauma that we've struggled with growing up, right through to losing that person. Sometimes when the person goes, you have not had the opportunity to deal or address any issues or unpack, or maybe sometimes even realize that you're carrying this trauma.
Mm.
Then you're hit by the second wave, which is grief. You've now lost that person.
Yeah.
So I love what you're saying, where we need to recreate culture.
Yeah.
Whilst we are still living now, recreate the culture of having to talk about things and open up Pandora's box. Then waiting for, Tracy was talking about unforgiveness. Do we have to forgive? Why do we need to even get to that point of not forgiving if we still have the people alive? I think I actually absolutely agree with you in terms of recreating culture.
Yeah. So just quickly, Trace, if I may, this is to differentiate compounded grief with complicated grief.
Mm-hmm.
Complicated grief is the grief that makes us believe we need to sanitize, to repackage. So we're not dealing with the hurt. We're not dealing with the hurt in the relationship that existed before the loss, whether it's a divorce, a separation, or a passing. And at the same time, that relationship with love, with compassion, with empathy, and how we marry these. And if we're able to do that, because we don't know how to do it, the system doesn't know how to do it, it becomes complicated grief. Because it actually, what it does is it suspends the grief cycle.
Okay.
So you can't continue to grieve.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Whereas with compounded grief is just not addressing it. Because you just can't open the lid, and then the next one hits you, and then the next one hits you. And if I can tell you a story around compounded grief, you laugh, because life has a way of just kicking you out of that little bubble you create. I lost one of my closest mothers. So the Lord gave me 6 mothers in life. That's just what a difficult person I am.
I needed 6 strong women to manage you,
to hold you down.
I needed the Mbokotos there with me. And my first one passed 31st of March. Marco, an angel in life. And then one of my spiritual mothers one of the most influential mothers. Magetlongwane passed the 16th of June. And then mom passed. This is the same year. And my mom passed on the 26th, or 27th of June. And then on the 9th of August, I lost the mom that taught me to be a mother, to be a woman, to hold a home, what it meant for children to be knit together. And I lost those women in that period of three, 4 months. I'd lost my grandmother 6.5 years before that. So I had 6 years of long grief. And then suddenly it was boom, 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 boom.
Maybe you no longer needed the Mbokotos.
Oh, I've got one left. I've got one left, thank God. And she would just remind me how to be a child again. Because doesn't grief do that? It just kind of has you just, you know, just bend down and fold into that fetal position. And my mother, my friend, my aunt, Joy Rockley Zwane, could just hold me when I lost my mom and just love me. I can't explain it. She had a way of just rubbing my tummy. And what healing touch brings in the time of grief. But if you noticed how we won't touch people in grief, it's that quick hug and then as if something's rubbing off us. And of course, in our culture, there is a belief that something is rubbing off us, hey Trace. They call it ismnyam. And so we need to avoid people that have experienced that for a period of time.
Is it like a contagion?
I mean, in the older days, it was crazy as women in black weren't allowed to walk on the same strip of road that everyone else was. So you're not only dealing with loss, but with the rejection of
stigma of your
community, of your loved ones, and then to process the stigma because did you kill someone? You just lost someone. And so we really need to be a lot tidier around the subject of death, how we treat each other, and how we create and hold space for people to grieve.
No, Willie, you're saying tidy, but I almost want to say we should be messier.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, like honest, raw, real, this business of sanitizing things. You touched on something earlier which hit a nerve with me when you said if someone you knew lost someone, you would then just be going with them.
Yeah.
And then you said, but nowadays we say, you know, is this my space? I think a part of that is because our networks or support systems or extended communities are by nature now more multicultural than they would have been 50 years ago. So now I've got Christian friends, Jewish friends, Muslim friends, black friends, white friends, Indian friends, and I can keep going. So when the rules of a culture are established by the fact that we're all from the same culture and we all understand the norms, because it's written into our socialization, but we are now coming together as a group of 10 or 15 people all representing a different culture, different religion. And I don't understand the norms of your cultural practice. I literally can't just jump in and do the thing that we know must be done because I literally do not know what that is. Whereas if we were from the same culture, I would know these are the needs of the family. This is the role I play. This is how I show up for them because we were socialized in the rules together. But I don't know how to show up for a Muslim friend, and my Christian friends wouldn't know how to show up for me if it was a Jewish funeral on my husband's side of the family. How do we communicate those needs now to one another? Right? So instead of saying, I don't know if this is my space, am I going to be intrusive if I show up with a cooked meal? Am I supposed to step in or step away? And then you get those ones who are like, I will pray for you. That's fantastic. But can you come to my house and do the laundry, please? Because that is what I actually need. How, if we're going to do this reconstruction of culture as a function of our multicultural society, what are the conversations we need to have going forward with our multicultural friends?
Firstly, I think we need to normalize death and the conversation. We are terrified of having that conversation in the workplace because we think it doesn't fit. And then my challenge is, do I leave myself at the door? And which part of myself do I leave at the door? A friend of mine lost her husband a couple of years ago, and I loved what she did, because can we also just be authentic in the time of loss? She just started crying in a board meeting, and she was the company secretary, and everyone just froze. And she looked at them, and she was got so angry, and she's like, continue. She's very sassy. And she said, continue. Don't you know tears? I'll be fine. But for me, it was, you know, what conversation had she had when she returned on that one, on that day? Because people don't know what to do with you, so people avoid you.
Exactly.
And so it's difficult to have the conversation. So we need to normalize conversation. So HR managers out there, start that conversation too, because, you know, work in the workplace, that's family. A collective is built on the foundations of family.
Yeah, it's your work tribe.
That's your tribe. And you're spending probably the longest part of your day with them. So if you're unable to say, having a bad moment, can I just step out? Or, Trace, you're not looking great. Are you sure, you're okay? Do you need anything? Hazel, can we just take a walk? And then just, you know, remove me from the situation and then say, I don't know what's up, girl, but I just have a feeling that you just needed to take a breather. You don't have to talk about it. Just learning how to hold space. We've got to be honest, ladies. It's so hard for people to hold space because they don't know how to start the narrative. And so dialogue, we've got to return to having conversation. So when someone comes back, why can't we just say, can we just, what happens in your family when you've lost someone? We're your work family. Could we just take 15, 20 minutes before we start the day and acknowledge that you're really, you're coming from a hard place. It's probably still hard, but just you knowing that we know and understand and are with you. What would that change, do you think?
Yeah.
If we could just do that. Because people don't want to feel like they're imposing.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we don't want to feel like we are transgressing because we are interfering. So how do we bring all these different emotions that actually are sending us further apart and widening the gap between us when we most need each other?
Yeah.
And I just think it's humanity. It's honor. Honor says, I see you. You matter. And so I want to know what's happening to you. And if we have that as a culture in an organization, then I don't think you're being intrusive, because I have the space to say and the latitude to say, not quite now, not ready. I'll let you know when I am. And then it's you know, the responsibility is mine to be accountable to that promise and come back and say, Trace, you started this conversation. I couldn't have it. Is this a good time for you? I'm ready to speak. And if we start talking about the things that are happening in our lives, we do it about our children. You know, we're excited about the birth of the child. We ask questions. But how do we just create an honoring space for someone who's grieving without sending them to ICAS?
There's another whole podcast conversation about that. this business of outsourcing our humanity to an organization because we are failing in the moment to just show up with empathy as human beings. Yeah, I'm going to need a very long episode for that conversation. You said something interesting now, and I want to take this from you, Willie, to Hazel. This question of what can I do? How often when you're sitting in grief can you actually answer that question? I can't think that I can say, well, what do I need? People say, like, what do you need? Let me know what I can do. But when you're sitting in grief, you're drowning in it. You don't know the answer. The thing about coming from the same culture or community is that I would never have needed to ask you that question. Hey, I would have known, this is the meal to prepare. This is what the kids need. I would have stepped in and met all the visitors in the door and made sure there was tea, coffee, milk, sugar, toilet paper, biscuits in your house for the parade of visitors. I would never have needed to ask the question.
And so we don't have the answer because the question didn't exist until very recently.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now I have to say, what do you need? Because my culture and yours are different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I genuinely don't know what to do. But I want to.
Yeah.
But you can't answer the question.
Yeah.
Because it was never a question until
no.
historically 5 minutes ago in terms of the human race.
Yeah.
And so we really must have these conversations. We're nearly out of time. So I think we've got to wrap up. And I mean, we could have spent all day on this one. As you were talking about children, I started thinking about grieving a pregnancy that is lost. And that is a person that only you knew. The father of that baby did not know that person. It's an imaginary person to everyone else, but a real person to you. So there is grief that we, you know, a topic that we could get into at a later stage. And yeah, grieving hopes and dreams and losses of things that you cannot put in a box and put in the ground is a whole nother podcast. So we'll have to have you back, Wally, for grieving the loss of things that we cannot bury physically, so we bury them within.
Yeah.
And what is the impact of that on our health and well-being in the world? Hazel, do you want to give us a parting comment or actually pick up any part of the conversation and just wrap it up for us?
So I want to touch on what Willie was saying about normalizing death. Normalizing death.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's just a shame that in this metro setting that has complicated a lot of things, lots of cultures, perspectives, and... But if we go back to the days of old, culturally, and I think I speak loosely for most cultures, there was a common understanding of what death was. Like, for example, in our African culture, we knew that death was not a final destination. It was, it was a state of transition.
Mm.
And there was a grieving process for both the alive and both the dead.
Mm.
And people were prepared for it.
Mm.
And when it came around, everybody knew what to do. Like what you say, Tracy, now we have to ask that question. Moving forward, I think we need to acknowledge that death is not going anywhere.
Right.
That's one thing we're guaranteed is going to happen in life. Of all things, we are all going down that road. If we start opening up those conversations and normalizing it and getting to know each other's cultures, understand each other's social settings and being kind to one another.
Mm-hmm.
That is the first step forward. And start, you know, like Tracy, I don't know if you remember Wan Jiao, what's her name? Nana, where she told us a story of the ladies in East Africa.
I was thinking about that just now. Yes.
Yes, and how widows are treated. Once your husband passes away, Willie, there's an expectation, some spiritualist needs to come and lay with you to remove that isinyama of you losing your husband. So that omen of losing your, and that's part of a level of violation.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the things that we need to start, and it's still being practiced this day and age. Mm-hmm. These are some of the things that we need to start looking at as a corporate, as a society, and start dealing with these things and normalizing certain things. I mean, if you're a widow, your husband is dead, he's dead. It's nothing to do with you. There's no omen around it. It's something that's guaranteed. I think that for me is, I guess my parting words, let's normalize death. Willie, I just repeat, let's normalize death.
Because the thing is that it's normal, right?
Yes,
so why do we even need to normalize? That's us saying let's normalize breathing and eating and it is, in fact, normal.
Yes.
What we have done is stigmatize it, label it, suppress it, avoid it, every other dysfunctional thing, when in fact it is the most normal and expected of things. You know, the survival rate for humans on Earth is zero. No one makes it out alive. You know, some of us have a longer runway than others, but no one makes it out alive. And if you can do to some extent, and while you're writing your obituary, the greatest gift my mother gave me was a funeral plan. And she wrote it in hospital while she was dying. And she wrote it on a two sides of an A4 page. Who must carry the coffin in and out? What hymns she wanted, what church she wanted, what dress she wanted to be buried in, and to make sure that this one didn't sit next to that one because they were arguing.
Mm-hmm.
The detail was extraordinary, and it was tear-stained. But I laminated that page, and I still have it to this day because it was the greatest gift. So if we can, to some extent, plan for our own death and take responsibility for this one fact, can we also, in that process, make the grieving process easier for those that are left behind? Wally?
My passion is always the kids.
The kids.
And I just want to remind us that we were those kids not so long ago. And when we don't teach kids about grief, about the language of emotion, they become the adults that we are today.
Scary.
Yep. And so the intentionality has to start at the foundational stage if you want to change this, because those children are so removed from just the concept of death. And so when you said no one's going to survive, my instinctual response was, speak for yourself, lady. I'm here forever. I need to torture some people. But the truth is, no one is really comfortable with it because it's not spoken about. And through the years, we've actually just lost our touch and feel around death. And it's a topic my children hate. But I started talking to them about it 3 Decembers ago, and I periodically go and I say, let's talk. Let's talk about death, what's going on. And it's getting easier and easier. So really, I think my final contribution to the conversation is, let's be intentional about speaking about loss and grief and the different types of grief. And how we hold space for each other. As a final word, there's a friend you should speak to. And she is an HR exec. And when we lost her mom, she looks at me, and I'll never forget her shock. She said, "Sizi, I've been playing with people's emotions." Because I'd say, "Oh, Sissy, I'm so sorry. I've heard about your loss. Please let me know what I can do for you." And what do? We send scones, we send flowers. And you're right. In that moment, I've lost my voice. I don't even know what I needed. I couldn't tell you even if I tried. And that's when the tribe has got to stand. And so I'm calling on our tribes. Know your tribe. Know how to show up. When you get that message, no one needs to tell you what to do. If you're part of a tribe, the conversation must be vibrant. It must be continuing. So I already have a list. I know. I even write songs, because when we are grieving, even the songs go. Everyone's looking at you to start the song. So I write little notes, and I give you all the ones that are good at singing to start the songs. And we keep it tight. We keep it intimate. We keep it together. And we allow a family to just let be and go where they need to. If they need to chat, let's not run away.
Let's
sit with them. You know, if they want to cry, let's hold them and let's not leave them after the funeral. Because the worst thing that this new way has brought is that terrible goodbye as we depart. And we have families who don't see people for weeks after they've lost a loved one. And they're left to their own devices.
Left alone.
That's not interdependent human life. That's not how we were created to be. And so it's just to remind ourselves, we are human. Honor is at the core of our very being. We know what it looks like. We know what it feels like. Let's offer it to each other.
Thanks, Willie. So I'll close us off with a giggle and tell you that I went on holiday with my family a good while ago, and quite a rural place, and this ground bird comes walking past, and my little swan says to me, oh, look at the birdie. So I say, this was years ago. He's 13 now. Mm. And I say, it's a chicken. And what erupted was a full-blown argument that that is not a chicken because chickens come from Woolworths. So when we talk about the separation of our understanding of death, my kid could not compute that this and the chicken from Woolies is in fact, we talk about the same chicken here. And so it is, it's fundamentally important, yeah. I think what you're saying is that we give them the full understanding of the life-death cycle. Maybe that's where pets come in handy, you know, and an opportunity to teach kids about life and death in the pet management process. But also to have real conversations about our longevity as human beings and real preparation and the languaging around death.
Yeah.
I've set up an email address for my children, and I periodically email them all sorts of things, their photographs and little baby drawings and all the things that I find, so they can start. It's a gathering place of their memories. Mm. But within that is preparation. So my policy document has gone to that email address. Mm. And also when we talk about tribe, my sisters, my best friend, their best friends and me and my best friend, so there's six of us, we've got a methodology we've worked out.
Mm.
So what is the activation process? If the first one dies, what happens? And we've actually got a plan of what is supposed to happen. And this tribe is multicultural. My best friend is Muslim. My sister's best friends are white. And for context, I'm colored. I know it's a podcast. You can't see me, but I am. And so it can be done, right, in this modern multicultural space and day and age. It can be done. It just requires, I suppose, courage and intentionality and taking your children to see chickens on an actual farm so they don't think that the chicken in Woolies is a chicken. Right? Because that's in their minds, it's almost like it's a vegetable. Right. It wasn't an alive thing before now. So how do we bring that consciousness home in our multicultural spaces?
Because we never stop talking. Could I just tell you about Dan? Dan the goat.
Tell us about Dan the goat, and then that'll be our last story. Dan the goat.
Yeah, so at my grandfather's funeral, my mom had gone with the kids while we were sorting things out. When I got there, there was just this tension in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't understand it. And my mom said, Sissy, Rory Sang, which is my middle child, has just traumatized us. Because my mom liked explaining to them, this is the neck of a chicken, and they'd already, and she didn't realize what she was doing. And she was like, strange smell. What meat is that, Gogo?
Mm-hmm.
And Gogo says, it's a goat, Nana. And then my daughter froze.
Mm.
And she said, Gogo, how could you? And then there was a goat that was passing. She said, you've killed Dan's cousin.
Everyone was confused. No one knew what to do. And Dan's cousin was there. So the identification of it now being like a pet as opposed to an animal for slaughter.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for a really rich, beautiful conversation. I think we are going to have you back, Willie, because there's so many more channels we can take this conversation down, and I think they're very, very important. But thanks. You've been amazing. Hazel, thank you so much. And that is a wrap. Thanks for joining us.
All right.
And Heal Your Mind with Tracy Cotson. Take care. Bye-bye.
Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Cotson is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.